This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hi, it's me again, Gary Clinton, here to introduce you to some old radio. The first one being an episode of Scape. One of the things I admire most about old radio is that they weren't shy about adapting classic stories to their own ends. Tonight's Escape, Drums of the Fore and Aft, originally aired on July the 14th of 1949 and is an adaptation of a Rudyard Kipling story about two 14-year-old drummer boys who, not from any particular courage of their own, but because they were drunk, are able to rally a frightened, inexperienced regiment. Oh, the program does make some minor changes to the original story, but they don't seem to particularly matter, as this is unquestionably, according to most people, one of the best episodes to ever air.
You are deep in the remote hill country of Afghan, face to face with the fierce Pathan warriors, trapped into a hopeless fight from which there seems no escape.
We offer you Escape, designed to free you from the four walls of today for a half hour of high adventure. Tonight, we escape to the north of India and to a battle long remembered, as Rudyard Kipling described it in his famous story, The Drums of the Fore and Aft.
When I came out from England to serve as a news correspondent with the British troops on the northwest frontier of India, I was attached to a regiment known as the Fore and Fit, Princess Hohenzollern's own Royal Light Infantry. Fore and Fit. But now, behind their backs, men call them the Fore and Aft. When certain words are shouted in front of other barracks, the troops may come out with belts and fists, but the mere whisper of Fore and Aft brings out the men of this regiment with rifles in their hands and murder in their eyes. I think perhaps the story of how the Fore and Aft got its name may be really more the story of Jakin and Piggy Lou, two of the toughest and most lovable little monsters who ever banged a drum or tooted a fife in a military band. They were both about the same age, with curly hair and the faces of cherubs, and inside were two souls that should have belonged to a pair of devils. I must have seen them before, of course, but the first occasion I can recall was at an informal court the colonel was holding in the orderly room one morning. Piggy and Jakin were there, and they were in trouble, as usual.
All right, Sergeant. Read the charges.
Yes, sir. The charge is made by one Smithers, a civilian, that while walking back of the bazaar at 6 p.m. last evening, he was set upon without provocation by two drummers from the regimental band known as Jakin and Piggy Lou, and by them was beaten into near insensibility.
Well, go on, Sergeant.
Mr. Smithers states further that he was struck down by the two defendants and while lying on the ground was kicked repeatedly in the face and ribs, escaping with his life only through the timely arrival of a detachment of the guard. That's all, sir.
Well, what about it? Jakin? Piggy? Is this the truth?
Oh, yes, sir. We gave him what for, all right.
That will do, Piggy.
Yes, sir.
All right, Sergeant. Turn them over to the bandmaster and have him tan their hides.
Yes, sir. Come on, you.
Wait a minute. Begging your pardon, sir, but can't we say nothing in our own defence?
What if a blooming civilian said he'd report you for having a bit of a barney with a friend? Suppose he tried to get money out of you, sir, and then he...
That will do, Piggy. You were fighting.
Well, only between ourselves, sir. That doesn't count.
We can't have no blinking civilians interfering with the business of Our Majesty's regiment.
All right. We forget the birching. But you're both confined to quarters for 3 days.
Oh, but, sir...
All right. Dismissed. And throw away that pipe when you get outside, Piggy. You're too young to be smoking.
Yes, sir.
Come on. Come on.
Confound it, Kipling. I don't know what to do with the lads. They're not really bad at heart, and they've never known any home with the army.
Hmm. Where do they come from, Colonel?
Oh, Jakin is from some back street in London, and Piggy Lou is straight off the Calcutta docks. Oh. And in both cases, ancestry unknown.
Well, they seem loyal enough to the regiment, at any rate.
They are, and loyal to each other in their own way. I'm inclined to think sometimes they've got more real spirit than all these new regulars put together.
Hmm. Aren't you a bit overloaded with green troops, Colonel?
Overloaded? My dear fella, 90% of the regiment were in Manchester factories or Lancashire farms 6 months ago. Can't make a soldier that length of time.
Any chance of action very soon?
Between ourselves, Kipling, we'll probably move north in about 10 days.
Uh-huh.
No, no, not to the front, of course. We'll give them a few months to shake down before they go into action.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's the only thing to do. There's one thing certain. This regiment is not ready for action yet. Only, don't write that back to your paper.
But the gods who govern armies seldom choose the wisest plan. On the Afghan border, a large force of Pathan guerrillas began massing near the Khyber Valley, being held in check temporarily by a regiment of Highlanders and a regiment of native Gurkhas. A week later, the Four and Fit, a regiment totally unprepared for action, was ordered to march north, contact the two regiments, and carry out a joint action to disperse the enemy. Parade ground and barracks began to hum with preparations for the coming campaign. Privates walked with a new swagger, and the young officers nearly shot one another at pistol practice. But to Piggy and Jakey, the excitement was like salt in an open wound. For the band was reduced to 20 men, and the drummer boys were being left behind.
Blimey, I won't let him do it to me, Jakin. Me, what's going to have a career in the army, being left behind like an old boot.
Oh, why should you worry? Now you can stay here with that blooming girl of yours.
Oh, what's a girl when the regiment's going to the front? And besides, how am I to explain to her about being left behind with the women?
What do you have to explain anything to her for? She's only 13.
I've been telling her I'd get myself a medal when the first campaign came along, and how am I to do it now?
I heard in the barracks they're going to take Tom Kidd along. He's to be the bugler. Of course, he's 18, though.
He may be 18, but I can plaster the wall with him any day, and with one hand behind my back.
Perhaps we could bash him round a bit. Oh, just enough so as he can't bugle no more. You could hold his hands, Piggy, and then I'll kick him in the...
No, no, no. He still wouldn't take us. Our reputations ain't what they might be, you know.
Yeah. Oh, well, for myself, I'd just as leave stay here and do a bit of loafing.
With our own regiment going into action, why, I'd as leave have my...
Oh, look who's coming. It's the blooming colonel himself.
And so it is, all alone. You know, Jake and my boy, I think I'll go and have a little talk with the colonel. You wait here.
Have you gone daft with the east?
Here, catch my pipe.
Blimey, now we're in for it again.
Begging the colonel's pardon, sir.
What's it?
Well, Piggy, are the drums in revolt?
No, sir. I'd like the pleasure of a word with you, sir.
All right. Go ahead and have it.
Well, sir, if you thought the world and all of your regiment, and it was going off to active service without you, sir, then how'd you feel?
I'm afraid I should feel a bit left out of things.
Oh, that's how Jakin and me feels about it, sir.
You've no idea what a campaign can be like, Piggy. Why, you'd flop in your face in the first 20 miles.
Oh, no, we wouldn't, sir. We're good at marching. I've told my girl I'd bring her back a medal. I've just got to go.
I see. think you could pass a physical?
Not the slightest doubt of it, sir. We're both of us very healthy for our age.
All right. I suppose it's unheard of for a regiment on the border to take drummers along on active service. But if you can pass the medical officer, you can both go along.
Oh, blimey! We're going to the front! Oh, I mean, thank you, sir. Jakin!
The regiment marched out of the station 2 days later, and all those left behind lined the road that led past the parade ground. The band stood by and played them out, waiting to fall in at the rear of the column. And although Jakin perspired and beat on his drum manfully to cover up, it was quite evident that Piggy Lou was not with the band. Jakin kept glancing at the cedar hedge behind him, and I had a pretty good idea why Piggy was being detained.
You've just got to be awful careful and take real good care of yourself, Piggy. You're so venturesome. I'd worry all the time.
It's hard, Chris. I'll grant you it's hard, but what's a man to do when his regiment's called on active service now? Yeah. Give us another kiss.
Oh, Piggy.
That's more like it.
If you'd have stayed here like you'd ought to, you could have had as many as you wanted.
And if I'd done that, Chris, you wouldn't think anything of me.
Like as not, but, well, at least I'd have had you with me, Piggy. And all the thinking in the world ain't like kissing.
And all the kissing in the world ain't like having a medal to wear on the front of your coat.
Oh, who cares about a medal? Just stay with me, Piggy, darling, and I'll love you true forever.
Well, ain't you going to do that anyhow, Chris? You said you was.
Oh, of course I am, but it'd be lots more comfortable if you stayed here.
Don't take on about it, Chris. I'll be coming back, and I'll marry you someday, too. I promise.
Oh, but when? Years and years, perhaps. You'll be careful, won't you, Piggy?
Well, a man has to take his chances in the army, Chris, but if it happens, I'll be thinking of you right to the last.
Oh, don't talk like that.
Oh, now, yeah. Give us a kiss.
Piggy, come on over here. We're about to fall in.
Oh, I've got to go now, Chris, my love. Don't you be forgetting me.
Oh, I won't ever, Piggy. Here, I made something for you to take with you.
What is it?
It's a button bag. All the regular soldiers carry them. I put some of me air in it.
Well, now, it's awful kind of you, Chris.
Oh, it ain't made so well, but I didn't want nobody else to help me, not even Mum.
I'll carry it right over my heart, so long as I'm alive.
Oh, don't say things like that.
Piggy, come on.
Give us one more kiss now. I can't stay no longer.
Oh, Piggy.
Goodbye, Chris. Take care of yourself.
Goodbye, Piggy. Be careful. Oh, be careful.
I'll be coming round to see you, Chris, my love, when I get back from the war.
Oh, Piggy.
Well, it's about time. And luckily we're not both in trouble. Here, stick this blinking fife in your ugly mouth and blow on it, petticoat chaser.
Just beat your drum, soldier, before I decide to beat on your ruddy head a bit. Tell the colonel he can shove off now.
And so the four and fit went north to the wars. First by troop train, and then on foot, when the last railhead left them with a 7-day route march before they'd reached the front up ahead. And during those 7 weary days, the regiment began to crack. The men weren't hardened to the long miles of marching, and they found themselves dead tired before noon of each day. The food was bad, and the water was worse. And on the second day, the snipers started in. They would hide in the tumble rocks of the low brown hills beside the road and wait for the column to pass. The first sign of one would be a flash and a puff of smoke. and some man on the long line of march would die without ever seeing the enemy who'd killed him. And even at night, the tired and nerve-shattered men could find no rest. If anything, the night hours in the dark tents were a good deal worse than the daylight hours on the dusty road.
Shut up, Piggy. I've got to get myself some sleep.
As if I ain't marched just as far as you have. Oh, my feet's fair killing me.
Well, it serves you bloody well right for getting us into this. We could be back in the barracks now, living on the fat of the land.
And halfway to becoming musicians, like as not.
In which case, I'd be sleeping in a regular bed and having some decent grub to eat for once.
I'm afraid you're not the army type, Jakin. Perhaps I shouldn't have talked my friend, the colonel, into letting you come...
Shut up in there! Tie that tent before I come in and take a belt to you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You don't have to go calling a blinking sergeant, sir.
There ain't no arm in it.
What?
That's the left wing! Stay in your tent!
Piggy... That's another one of our sentries got himself killed out there.
Them paternal beggars can sneak up in the dark without making a sound. Then they take their bloody long knives and slice a man
all
open
right.
as neat as you please.
Hold your fire till you see what you're shooting at.
I wonder what they look like, Piggy, these here paternals.
What's it matter when we can't even carry rifles? I ask you now, Jakin, look at this in my hand. How's a man to get himself a medal when all he's got for a weapon is a bloomin' fife?
Late afternoon of the seventh day, weary, savage, and sick, their uniforms dulled and unclean, the four and fit rendezvoused with the Highland Regiment.
Hey, lads, here comes the new regiment, the Four and Fit.
The Four and Fit, eh? And may I ask, what is it they're fit for?
Some of the men bore wounds, and some were stretcher cases. But the real casualty was the regimental morale. These raw recruits had marched out of their station in the south with the band playing, and somehow they'd imagined they might march gloriously into battle the same way. But no band played when they slogged to a stop at the brigade encampment.
Blimey! Look at them chaps over there wearing petticoats.
A lot, you know. They're islanders, me lad. And I've heard a man had best take no liberties with them.
Oh. Well, Piggy, do you think we found the ruddy war at last?
What else? Ain't that a full-blown general over there talking to our colonel?
Had a bit of a rough time of it coming down, sir. My men have been rather mauled and no chance of a fair return. They only want to go someplace where they can see what's before them.
I understand, Colonel. I wish I could let you have a few days to recover, but I simply can't spare you just now.
Oh, there'll be no need of it, sir. All we're wanting is one good night's rest.
I see. Well, you can pitch your camp next to the Highlanders, Colonel, and I suggest you call a general inspection before dark. We plan to attack the enemy position at dawn.
Very good, sir.
So, it's active service you wanted, Piggy, eh? And how much longer do you think they're going to keep us standing here with the bloody daylight barely coming over the hills?
Just take a look at them Patans out there on the plain.
Must be eight of them to one of us, right down the line.
It makes it that much easier to get a medal.
Now, how do you hope to get a medal? Maybe you're going to blow their bloody eardrums in with your little fife.
More like it. We'll not even have a chance to see how the beggars look. The band, as you might have heard, is going to wheel and retire when we reach them rocks out there, while the regular soldiers go in and attack the enemy.
Which, I might say, is exactly the way I'd plan it myself. I got no fondness for being sliced up like a leg of lamb.
Ah, you got no spirit, Jakin.
Them as want spirit can have it. As for me, I... Oh, here we go, Piggy.
Right, George, Jakin. Ready now.
The two, by the right, we march!
Watch yourself now, Jakin, and step lively. Just keep your eye on me, and I'll make a bloody hero out of you.
Only someone had blundered. Someone had misread an order. And the four and fit moved out onto the plain to attack the enemy force alone.
The four and fit's moving out.
At the clump of rock, the band wheeled and halted and continued to play, while the ranks opened to form a skirmish line and moved slowly ahead.
Hold steady, laddies. We have no orders to move out, and therefore we'll stand fast the new. If the four and fit wishes to fight like hogs, then they'll
at
fight.
At 500 yards range from the enemy line, the regiment began firing at will. At will and wildly. In a few minutes, they'd thrown away half of their ammunition and blinded themselves with their own smoke. And farther out on the plain, the Afghan army stood quietly, firing occasional well-aimed bullets into the milling herd of green troops.
The brainless fools, they're bunching like a herd.
Suddenly, from the main body of the Afghan troops, a small band of about 50 Pathan warriors charged forward and fell upon the startled Englishmen. These were the Ghazis, the suicide squad, always thrown out ahead of the Afghan army before any main test of strength. Swinging their long, heavy knives, they struck the close-packed British line.
In the name of heaven, don't they extend into open order? They'll be
the four and fit wavered, reeling away from the vicious slashes of the murderous bone-handled knives, rallied for an instant and held, then broke, turned tail, and ran.
Will you look at them laddies? They turn and run.
I might say they make better speed to the rear than they made to the fore.
They're anything but four and fit now. More like it to call them the four and aft.
It'll take them a long time to live that one down. At the four and aft.
The regiment took no thought for the wounded, for the men leapt behind. Nor did they stop until they jammed in the pass that led up to the hill. And the band, too, was carried along with them in their headlong flight. All the band, except two men.
Piggy, you think them bloody Pathan beggars can see us hiding here in the rocks?
Oh, of course not.
Well, I hope you're right.
Blooming cowards, running away. Now, weren't that a fine way for a British regiment to act?
Had we done the same thing, we'd not be left behind here the way we are.
Now, what's got into you? You're comfortable, ain't you?
I may be comfortable, but I ain't easy in me mind.
Ah, put a sock in it. Hey, look, somebody's dropped the canteen there. Mm. Maybe it's got rum in it.
Well, now, how can you hope to tell by shaking it?
Here now, keep your dirty hands off it. I'll do the trying it out.
Well, is it, Piggy? Is it?
No, it's water. Oh. Here, have yourself a free drink on Her Majesty, drummer boy.
Righto.
Jacob, look.
What?
Them Pathan beggars is starting back for their own lines. Hey, keep your head down.
Well, now with the blooming enemy retiring, perhaps our lads will come out and rescue us.
Not them, the bloody cowards.
Well, don't they know the Pathans ain't chasing them no more?
They can't see nothing but their own precious skins. Afamo. Maybe we ought to give them a little music, show them it's all nice and cozy out here now.
What? Do you want us to go and get our blinking selves shot?
Oh, they ain't no enemy close by now. Come on, Jacob, take up your bloody drum there.
Here, are you positive there was only water in that canteen?
Oh, so like as not you're a coward too, the same as the rest of the regiment.
What? I'll show you who's a coward, Piggy, my boy. Here, take your blooming fife. There. And stick it in your ugly face.
Well, now, so you have got a bit of spirit. Maybe I'll speak to my old friend the Colonel about it.
Oh, shut up and start blowing. You ready?
Ready all. Now.
Where is it we're going to march to, Piggy?
Back and forth a time or two in full sight. Then we'll wait in the rocks for the battle to start. Are they watching us?
Yeah, they're watching us. Oh, yes. They're watching us, all right.
Time held still, and even the Afghan snipers forgot their weapons, while two armies watched the tiny, red-coated figures marching back and forth on the battlefield alone.
Aye, and I'll tell you for certain, there's a pair of brave laddies down there.
All right, you bleeding cowards! Look at them out there! Are them two children the only brave men in the regiment?
The men of the fore and aft lifted their heads, fingered their rifles, and stared without moving. And out there on the silent plain, back and forth marched Jakin and Piggy.
Have we got to play these blooming instruments all day long? Ain't the blighters ever going to come back?
Shut up, Jakin. Keep playing.
Well, all I might say is, I shouldn't have ever let you talk me into this. I ain't cut out for active service anyway. I should bloody well feel more comfortable if I was back in the barracks. I was back in...
Jakin. Jakin. Oh, you bleakin' heathen blighters! You've killed Jakin! All right, I'll show you who's afraid of you! Come on, you blooming cowards!
Two armies saw them die from the sniper's bullets. Two armies, and the men of the fore and aft.
All right, men of the regiment, what now? Those two at least were brave enough to know how to die.
Pigs, bandits! This time we attack, and there'll be no turning back!
Look at them, laddies. The fore and aft, they're going back to fight.
Aye, look at them run. That's how it should have been done the first time.
Aye, laddies, and now is the time for us. Orders or no, here's where we join the fight. Company, prepare to charge! Charge!
Late afternoon saw the Afghan army wiped out, and the general explained to me how everything had gone according to his plan, and how he hoped I'd cable that back to my paper in London right away. I turned and left him then, and walked across the silent battlefield, walked out among the silent dead. The two tiny figures lay quite close together, Jakin fallen across his broken drum, and Piggy Lou with the fight still clenched in his dirty fist. A bulge under his tunic caught my eye, and I reached in and drew out a button bag, embroidered crudely with the name Chris.
I made it for you myself, Piggy darling, and I put some of my own hair inside of it.
I'll wear it right next to my heart, Chris, so long as I'm alive.
I thought how Chris would soon forget, and how the world's memory is no longer than hers. The sun was sinking away into the west. The button bag in my hand was soaked, damp, and over the left breast of Piggy's grimy uniform, over the pocket where decorations are usually worn, a brighter red stain had spread out through the coarse wool, looking very much like the bright red ribbon that goes with a medal.
Escape is produced and directed by Norman MacDonald. Tonight we have presented Drums of the Fore and Aft by Rudyard Kipling, adapted for radio by Les Crutchfield. Featured in the cast were Ben Wright as Rudyard Kipling, Hugh Thomas as Piggy Lou, and Terry Kilburn as Jakin, with Colleen Collins, Ramsey Hill, Alec Harford, Wilms Herbert, and Tudor Owen. Special music arranged and conducted by Wilbur Hatch. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week when once again we offer you Escape. Tip Corning speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. ¶¶
Yes, sir, life is swell when you keep well. And say what a really swell cereal Post Bran Flakes are. Crisp and crunchy. And what a wonderful nut-like flavor. And then those extra benefits. The benefits of bran so many of you may need to help you keep fit naturally. So why don't you join the millions who enjoy Post Bran Flakes every day for their delicious flavor, for their extra benefits. Yes, life is swell when you keep well.
M&J Audio Theater presents Chet Cheddar's Tales from the Morgue.
Come right in, my friend.
Yes.
Have a seat. Welcome to my damp little piece of heaven. I am Chet Chetta, the morgue attendant and resident storyteller. You've caught me in a nostalgic mood today. I was remembering back to the golden age of radio. Oh, the days before television and computer games. The days when the radio was the nucleus of family entertainment. Oh, the sound was a bit crude. There was a great deal of static, but it didn't matter. We would gather around the entire family and listen to stories. Oh, there were soap operas and dramas and comedies. And my favorite of all, the scary stories, yes. Oh, tales of suspense and murder. They catered to your deepest fears. And they sounded something like this.
Ladies and gentlemen, the stories you're about to hear contain images of pure terror. Therefore, we warn you, if you or anyone in your family has a weak heart or bad nerves, please turn off your radio now. The makers of this program will not be held responsible for anyone who dies of fright or goes insane. Remember, you have been warned.
Turn out your lights. Lock all your doors and windows. Listen, do you hear that? It is the beating of your own heart. Beating harder and harder and harder in anticipation of the horror that is about to take place. You can feel it all around you. It is a dark, black, hideous cloud of dread. You're paralyzed with fear. There's no escape from Terror Theater! Today's story of fright, revenge, and the prospective bias. I hope you enjoy our little tale for today. It's too late to turn back.
You heard right, ma'am. That's right. $100 an acre. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I know it's cheap, but it's darn good land, ma'am. Well, see, ma'am. The IRS says I got to sell off my land. Yes, ma'am. I got so busy tending to my crops that I forgot to pay my taxes for 3 years, and it kind of builds up, you know. Yes, ma'am. But you say you're going to come over tomorrow at 7 o'clock? That's fine, ma'am, just fine. You come on over then. Bring your hubby. I'll show you around. Okay, ma'am. See you then. Yeah. Yeah, you just come on down. Old Jody will show you all around. And then Jody's going to show you something else.
Jody Brown, a simple man, a proud farmer who finds his livelihood in jeopardy. But Jody has a plan to save his precious land. It is an evil plan that will ensure Jody Brown a place in hell.
Well, here she is.
Oh.
35 acres.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
Gorgeous, honey. And look at those trees. Aren't those Scottish pines?
Well, that's right on the money, mister. I like a man that knows his trees. You see them birds up in them trees there?
Yes.
Them are grackles.
Oh.
You fry them up just right and they're dandy tasting.
Well,
they taste a little like chicken.
But does the house come with the land, sir?
My house. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. The house comes with the land. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. There's something I want to show you, folks. Watch what I can do with this shovel here. Now, you got some dandy, fertile land here. Watch how easy the shovel breaks up this ground. Watch it.
Oh!
Well, if that isn't the cat's meow, honey.
Say.
You plant you some corn and a big vegetable garden, and you can live off this land. I've been doing it myself for 40 years.
Oh, honey, I want the land. I want the house right now.
Now there's one more thing I want to show you before we finalize the deal,
yes.
Okay? I want you to take a gander straight ahead there past that hill.
Uh-huh.
Now, the sun sets about this time every evening, and I tell you, it's more beautiful than a picture postcard. Now, just look straight ahead there. You see it?
Well, I'll be. That is one pretty sunset, honey.
Oh, it's just gorgeous.
Painted
by God himself. Now, that's right. You just look straight ahead and just look at that sunset.
Oh,
just drink it all in.
Darling, it's so pretty.
Yeah, that's right.
I just can't stop looking at it.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow, it's just
so ain't that a pretty sunset? Don't you like it, mister? Ain't that a pretty sunset? It's the last one you'll ever gaze upon. Actually, I thought I was going to give my land away for $100 an acre. Darn woman even wanted my house. Well, I guess it's time to get you two in the ground. Get in that hole. I'll just cover you up here. Out of sight, out of mind, I always say. And then I just dump your car in the swamp when I'm through. Oh, but they'll keep coming. And the tax man made me put that ad in the paper. They're going to keep coming, but I'll be ready for them. I got plenty of room for them. Yeah, when the tax man comes, I'll just say, no, sir. Nobody's come to look at this land, no, sir. And then he'll get discouraged and give me my land back to me, yeah. And if he don't, there's plenty of room for him here, too. I got room for them all. Because nobody's taking my land away. This land is part of me. Nobody's taking me off of it. Nobody.
Day by day, Jody carried out his demented plan.
Right over there is where you can raise you some cattle.
Day by day.
The land's perfect. I'll take it.
Take this and stay it.
Week by week.
Oh, listen to the birdies twang.
You listen to this shovel against your skull.
The death toll continued for 1 month. Until one fateful night, when Jody, asleep in his bed, dreaming peacefully, heard a noise.
What's that? What's that sound? Sounds like something falling out of the ground. Now don't come unwound, Jody. Yeah, it's just a gopher. Yeah. A bunch of gophers. That's all it is. Just gophers. Just go back to... Oh, someone's at the door. Who is it? Now, you get out and away from here, you hear? This is private property. Private property. You get out of here.
We're coming in, Jody.
No. No. Oh, you can't be here. I killed you. I killed you all. I buried you in the ground. No.
We'll take the land, Jody. We'll take the land.
No. You stay away from me now. You stay away from me. You ain't gonna take me off my land.
Don't worry, Jody. We won't take you off your land.
Stay away.
Like you said, this land is part of you now. You're gonna be part of it.
No. Stay away from me. Stay away from me. No!
I appreciate your coming out here with me, Sheriff.
We told
Mr. Brown if he didn't have his property sold by the end of the month, we would have to take control of the land.
Yeah.
He may refuse to leave them.
Well, it doesn't appear to be in the house. It might be in the barn. Hey, Mr. Brown! It's the sheriff out here! Why don't you get your body on out here, boy? We need to talk to you right now.
Sheriff, look.
Yeah.
Look over here. Over here behind the house.
What in the world? It's a big mound of dirt.
Yes, and there's footsteps leading up to it. And look what's on top of the mound. It's a sign. It says, "This property has been sold." Oh, my God. Sheriff, look. Sticking out of the top of the mound, it's a human hand.
Poor Jody found out just how fertile his land was, didn't he? Why, just plant a few dead bodies and they sprout right up. Well now, our next excursion into fear is about a very nervous man named Arnold Craig. We begin inside the room of a psychiatric hospital. Mr. Craig is lying on a couch. He appears to be at wit's end.
Listen. I am not crazy, doctor. I'm not. I may be having a nervous breakdown. I'll give you that. But I'm not insane. And I will not lie here and have you condescend to me like I'm some sort of child who thinks he's seen the boogeyman.
Mr. Craig, I am here to help you. You just calm down. Maybe we can talk about this thing rationally.
You want to help me? You want to help me? And give me a gun so I can blow my brains out. Let me end it now before they find me.
Who is they, Mr. Craig?
The cars. They won't rest until I'm dead.
Cars, you say? You're talking about automobiles?
Yes. Yes, they hate me. They hate me because they know I hate them. Don't look at me that way, doctor.
Now, calm down. Everything's going to be all right.
Oh, shut up. Oh, I know what you must be thinking. I know what you must be writing on that pad of yours. Your schizophrenia, probably. Yeah. But I'll tell you my story, doctor. I'll tell you. You're probably too simple to see it other than the ravings of a madman, but I'll tell you if only to purge my soul of this terror.
Remember, Mr. Craig, it is a 50-minute session.
Shut up. I'll take as much time as I please. It won't matter in the end anyway. For 12 years, doctor, I've worked in an auto junkyard. My job was operating a machine that compacts the cars into a small cube. It was a perfect job for me, you see, because I've always hated cars. Hated the way they sounded, the way they polluted the air. The grating sound of the horns. See, you can understand my intense pleasure when I would start the compacting machine and watch as the cars collapsed under the intense hydraulic pressure. I was thrilled by the sound of a car being crushed, the sound of steel buckling under intense pressure. It was like they were screaming in pain. Oh, how I love that sound. Die. Die.
Say, Craig, you really love this job, don't you?
Oh, yes, sir. I love it. I love it. I hate cars, and I want to destroy them all.
You're a weird man, Craig, but you're a hard worker. I'll see you back here tomorrow morning.
Oh, is it closing time already? How time flies when you're having fun.
It was only 2 days ago, Doctor. It's funny how little time it takes for things to go completely haywire. It was a beautiful afternoon. I was riding home from work on my bicycle the way I had done for 12 years. I went by the park as I enjoyed doing on beautiful days like that. It was the picture of serenity. Then behind me, I heard a car engine. Now, Doctor, I always stay on the shoulder of the road, away from traffic. But this car was right behind me. I looked over my shoulder, and there was a station wagon, a blue station wagon, directly behind me. The driver had a puzzled look on his face. I yelled at him.
Now, see here, you moronic goat. Why are you following me? Why don't you take that thing and drive it off a cliff?
Suddenly, the car accelerated. The bumper met with my back wheel. It was trying to run me over, Doctor. It blew its horn as if in anger. I had to think fast, so I pedaled as fast as I could into the park. But the car stayed behind me. People were running in fear. I began to lose control of my bike. I fell to the ground behind a tree, and the car smashed into it. That tree saved my life, Doctor. The man inside the car looks dazed. He had a small bump on his forehead, but otherwise he was unharmed. He got out of the car and rushed over to me.
Hey, mister. Hey, say, are you right? You okay?
Why did you try to run over me?
I didn't, mister, I swear. I didn't even have control of the car. I didn't even touch the wheel.
What do you mean you didn't have control of the car? I went into the park and you followed me.
The car followed you by itself, mister. I swear, it followed you like a magnet. I couldn't control it. It was like it had a mind of its own.
Like it had a mind of its own. Yes. Yes, exactly. Think me insane if you wish, Doctor, but at that precise moment I knew what had happened. The car was trying to kill me. Somehow, it sensed my hatred for cars and considered me an enemy to be destroyed. Impossible? Yes. Insane, perhaps, but it's true, Doctor. True. Despite that horrible realization, I managed to fall asleep that night. But my slumber was short-lived. It was about midnight when a peculiar sound awakened me. Oh, what's that? What's that outside? Sounds like car engines. Those lights shining through the window. Dear heavens. Out there, surrounding the house. Cars. And they're empty. No one's inside the cars. They're waiting for me. Want me to come out
wants me to come outside so they can... Well, they'll have a long wait. You hear me? You hear me? I'm not coming out. You'll run out of gas before I come out. You think I'm a murderer, don't you? Yes, Arnold Craig, murderer of cars. That's me. Well, go away. Go away, do you hear me? Go away. But they didn't go away, Doctor. Simultaneously, they blew their horns. The windows of my house shattered. And then I passed out cold. It's horrible to contemplate the possibilities of reality, Doctor. The terror and hopelessness overwhelmed me like a criminal walking to his execution. But unlike a criminal walking to the electric chair, I could defend, I could fight, I could resist. I had a gun, and with it I could blow out every tire on every car that threatened my existence. In my front yard there was silence, no cars in sight. So I waited all day. The sun set. All night I stood. Nothing. Days passed and I stood with my gun routinely rotating in all directions, ready for the moment when they would attack. But after 5 days I began to give up. It seemed the cars were gone for good. I'm free. I'm free. Surely they would have attacked me by now. Oh, thank God I'm rid of this life-threatening nuisance. Then I heard a car from the distance. I ran into the street and saw a car at what looked like half a mile away. It was speeding at me at an incredible rate. I aimed the gun, waiting for the car to get close enough so I could open fire. And when it did, I didn't hold back.
Die! Demons of hell! Die! Die! Die!
But I missed the tires. I was directly in its path. I only had time to jump in the air in hopes of avoiding death. But after standing for 5 days, my jumping abilities were severely limited. I crashed through the windshield at an astonishing 60 miles an hour. I began firing bullets into the dashboard. Surely this would disable the filthy good-for-nothing car. Much to my disadvantage, it did. It swerved out of control and smashed into the base of the town water tower, causing it to plummet on top of both of us. After 5 months of reconstructive surgery, I was out of the hospital and thirsty for revenge.
Welcome to Big City Hardware. How may I...
Don't be alarmed by this sack over my head, lady. I don't want the cars to recognize me.
Cars?
Give me a sledgehammer, quickly.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's a very nice sack you have, sir. Here you go, sir. Please don't hurt me.
I'm not going to hurt you, lady. But you have to understand, every automobile must be destroyed.
Yes.
Here's your money. Thank you, lady.
Yes. Mr. McKenzie.
Yes.
Mr. McKenzie.
Yes, Linda.
Lunatic. Lunatic outside with the sledgehammer. Look, he's smashing my car.
I'll call the police right now.
Die. Die. I'll kill you all. Kill you all!
Hey, what's going on, man?
Die, you foul beast!
Hey.
Die!
Hey, if you flipped your gourd, man, that's my car. Give me that thing.
Release me, you fool! I have to destroy them all. There's millions, and I haven't much time.
What did my car do to you, man?
It would try to kill me. Sooner or later, they will all try to kill me.
And they're not cars, my young man. They're beasts. They're animals. Demons with gasoline for blood. And I must destroy them all. Die! 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 Die!
Die. Die. Yes. Yes, I suppose I did look like a maniac, Doctor. I suppose to the untrained eye I looked like a sledgehammer-welding madman. I tried to explain to the policemen when they arrived what I was doing, but, well, here I am. So, you've heard my story. What do you think, Doctor?
Well, Mr. Craig, I'm afraid I'm going to have you committed probably for the rest of your life if you show no sign of improvement.
Yes. Yes, I thought you would say that. But you see, that would be very dangerous for you, Doctor, because they'll find me sooner or later. And when they do, they'll... There. There, do you hear that, Doctor? Do you hear that? It didn't take them long to find me, did it?
Mr. Craig, I... Well, there does seem to be a car out there by the window revving its engine, and goodness, there is no driver.
Yes. Yes, they found me. They found me. Well, okay. Okay. I'm ready. I'm ready for you. Come on. Come on.
Mr. Craig.
Take me.
Mr. Craig.
Take me.
Mr. Craig.
Take me.
Mr. Craig, do not antagonize the car. I will call security at once.
That'll do no good, Doctor. No good.
It's backing up. It's
yes.
Coming forward.
Yes.
It's,
come on.
It's heading for the window.
Come on. Come on.
Well, it looks like Mr. Craig's psychiatrist has learned that what seems like obsessions and delusions can in fact bring a quick and merciless death. But on the bright side, Mr. Craig was put out of his misery.
Well, there you are. Two spine-chilling excursions into fear. It's too bad that storytelling has evolved into high-tech special effects, nudity, and mindless violence. So often I hark back to the days of old-time radio when the imagination was the special effects department. Oh, well, the price we must pay for progress. I see you're ready to go. Well, please keep me in mind. I have many more stories to tell. Until next time, pleasant dreams.
You have just heard Chet Cheddar's Tales from the Morgue. Today's installment, Excursions in Fear. The names and characters portrayed in this production are fictitious. Any similarities with actual persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
And kind of amazing. I don't know about you, but I really have very little objection to mindless violence and nudity.
Dental.
Well, little objection in my fiction. Well, we're going to take a bit of a break right now, but we'll be back very soon with X minus one.
From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight's story, Jaywalker, by Ross Rocklin.
Intergalactic flight number 14 now loading at ramp 10. Intergalactic flight number 14 now loading at ramp 10. Please have your flight validation.
You walk from the waiting room down the long ramp number 10. The flight pack is in one hand, the validation papers in the other. Other passengers chatter behind you. You turn a corner, and there's the ship. A cylinder of glistening silver aimed at the moon. You feel yourself carried up the moving stair to the gaping entrance lock. A pretty stewardess in a blue uniform smiles at you.
Validation papers, please? Your papers, madam.
Oh, papers? Oh, yes, here they are.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Marcia Foster. You feeling well, Miss Foster?
Yes, quite well, thank you.
We have to make sure. Once in a while, somebody slips aboard with another person's validation papers.
What difference would it make if I felt well or not?
Great deal, I'm afraid. You see, the effect of a free fall in space without gravity can do quite a bit of damage in certain glandular conditions. I see you've passed your physical.
Yes, I'm quite all right.
It's fine. Have a nice trip. Your seat number is 15. Next, please.
You walk down the carpeted aisle to the Plasticon seat. Her words make a ringing pattern in your brain. Are you feeling well, Mrs. Foster? Mrs. Foster's feeling quite well, thank you. Mrs. Foster has passed her physical examination. There's only one thing wrong with the picture. You are not Mrs. Foster.
Attention, please. Attention. In 1 minute, the flash walls will be raised around the ship. If for any reason a passenger is not feeling well or does not wish to make the trip, please speak up.
1 minute. You begin to wonder if you ought to go after all. You begin to think of how it happened. Why you're here sitting in this silver vessel waiting to blast off for the moon. What happened between you and Jack? What happened?
Honey, I'm back.
Jack, oh, darling.
Oh, you miss me?
Did I miss you?
Oh. I brought you a little present from the moon.
What is it?
Open it and see.
All right, I will.
Try it on.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Took us 2 hours to pick it out.
Us?
Oh, me and Sue. Sue Egan.
Well, who's she?
Well, the stewardess on the ship.
Oh? How long has she been on the Earth-Moon run?
Oh, I guess it's about a year now.
It's funny you never mentioned her.
Oh, haven't I? Well, what's the difference?
It just seems odd.
Hey.
What?
Well, you're not jealous, are you?
Is she pretty?
Oh, monstrous. 4 feet high and 3 feet around. And she has a big blue eye right in the middle of her forehead.
Oh, you're insane.
Come on, how about a kiss?
No.
Oh, lady, I've been away for 4 months.
Sorry.
I guess I'll just have to go back to Sue Egan and her 3 blue eyes.
Oh, in that case. Here.
Oh. I have been away a long time.
Jack, I want to talk to you about that.
Okay, but could it wait till tonight? I am taking you to dinner, Mrs. McLean.
I'd rather talk about it now.
Okay.
Jack, we've been married for 6 years now.
Is it that long?
7 in July. For the last 2, you've been skippering that rocket to the moon.
I know.
3 weeks at a time, with only a week in between.
Well, I do get a month vacation,
Jack,
besides.
That is no kind of life.
Oh, Marsha, I don't know what I can do about
it. You haven't tried to do anything about it.
I guess you're right.
Do you intend to try?
Marsha...
But I need to know.
Marsha, flying is my whole life.
But it isn't mine. I'm not going to spend 3 weeks out of 4 sitting here wondering if you'll come back alive.
Oh, now that's ridiculous.
Is it? What about my father who died on the Elsinore when it missed Mars?
Your father died as the result of a space maneuver that no pilot in his right mind would try.
They missed the planet. That could happen to anybody.
They missed it because they tried to warp the ship around.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Well, it isn't very hard to understand. A spaceship takes off with everything calculated to the last decimal point. It has exactly enough fuel to take it to a planet if it follows an exact course, an ironclad mathematical orbit.
Well?
Well, there was a jaywalker aboard the Elsinore.
A jaywalker?
Well, that's what we call somebody who boards a ship knowing that he has no business doing so. In this particular case, it was a senator going to a convention on the moon. He had been taking endocrine treatments and kept it secret on his validation papers. He felt he had to attend this convention to muster some votes for his campaign. He didn't consider that he was jeopardizing his life.
Well, I still don't see how they missed the planet.
6 hours out, the senator began to die. The effect of the free fall on his glands was catching up with him. And the only way to reverse that effect is to reverse the spin of the ship, turn it end over end. That creates artificial gravity, reverses the stress on the glands. The pilot took a chance. He did just that.
Is that why they missed the planet?
They lost their trajectory. By the time they recalculated their course, they'd passed Mars. They ran out of fuel and kept going until... Well, until they fell into the gravity of the sun.
And that couldn't happen today?
A pilot would have to be out of his mind to try a maneuver like that.
You wouldn't try it.
Risk an entire ship to save the life of one fool?
You wouldn't.
Marsha, I can't say I definitely wouldn't. Right now, it's inconceivable.
Just as inconceivable for you to give up spaceflight for my sake.
Isn't it equally inconceivable for you to put up with it for my sake?
I've put up with it for 2 years. Jack, this is the end of it.
Now, what exactly do you mean by that?
I mean you have to decide whether you want a marriage and a family or a career as a space jockey.
Well, why do I have to decide? Why can't I have both?
Because I won't live this way. Nobody else does except a handful of wives whose husbands are crazy enough to have picked a profession like this.
Well, you knew this was my profession when you married
me. I didn't know it was like this.
Marsha, what you're asking me to do, I simply can't do. Wouldn't make you happy if I did. I'd just be walking around resenting you. Now, come on. Let's have dinner and forget this for a while.
No. We're not having dinner.
You'd rather stay home tonight?
No. I'm going to Los Angeles to my mother's house.
What?
I have tickets on the 6 o'clock flight.
Tonight?
Yes. Jack, I'm quite determined. I've made up my mind that I'd put it to you squarely, and if you refused, I was leaving.
Just like that?
Yes. I've had all I can take.
Marsh, for heaven's sake, can't we talk this over and make some kind of a compromise?
There is no compromise, Jack. It's all very exciting for you, tearing back and forth to the moon with glamorous stewardesses and all sorts of celebrities, but sitting here waiting isn't much fun for me.
Well, you could get a job. You could develop some interest.
That isn't why I married you. I want a home and a family and a man who comes home every night and talks to me about little, unimportant things.
And I'm not that man.
No. No, you're not.
Okay.
What are you doing?
I don't like people walking out on me, so I'm leaving first.
Would you mind telling me where you'll be?
I don't know. You can reach me through Intergalactic if you change your mind. Marsha, maybe we'll both be better off. We didn't have much of a home life anyway, just the two of us. I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. I know how you feel about not having children. Goodbye, Marsh.
There it was. We learned when you came back from Los Angeles 2 months later that he'd been seen in the company of one Susan Egan, stewardess for Intergalactic on numerous occasions. He learned, too, that he'd applied for the Earth-Venus run, the newest and most difficult run in the galaxy. And you learned something else. Something that was going to change the whole course of your life.
Come in, Mrs. McLean. Sit down.
Thank you, Doctor.
I have some good news for you.
Yes?
You're going to have a child. Well, I thought you'd be happy about that.
Happy? Oh, yes. Yes, I am. Naturally. You debated for a long time, and then you called the intergalactic office. Mr. McLean was out on the Earth-Moon run. He'd be back on the 12th, but only for an afternoon. He was taking off again immediately. They were so sorry. You were sorry yourself. It seemed as if life would not be worth living without Jack, especially now with a child on the way. You had to talk to him, to be with him. That was when you first began to formulate the idea of going to the moon with him on this run.
Attention, please, attention. We're about to count down for blastoff. Fasten your seat belts and recline back as far as possible. The next sound will be that of the first stage rockets heating up. Do not be alarmed by the vibration of the ship.
From the bulkheads overhead, everywhere comes the deep rumbling sound. Some of the passengers look anxious, some excited. Some leaf casually through magazines as they lie on their backs in the reclining seats.
Those of you who've never been in rockets will find it an experience that will make you proud to belong to the human race.
Countdown for blastoff. X minus 5, minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, minus 1, 0.
The rumble heightens. All emotion leaves you. Cold, ravening fear takes over. You try to close your eyes, your ears against it, but your mind won't respond. You look out the port, and the scene is suddenly splashed with a rushing sheet of flame that darkens the sky and is torn from your vision. It's snatched away. The buildings, the trees, the roads vanish. A great, soft, uniform weight presses down on you. You push with all your might, but it smothers you, presses you back, drives your blood down, down inside of you. And then, quiet.
We are now 102 miles over New York City. You may unfasten your safety belt. The pull of gravity will no longer trouble you.
You unfasten the safety belt and sit in the seat, wondering what to do next.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to intergalactic flight number 14 out of New York Rocketport, destination Moon. I'm your hostess, Miss Susan Egan. Your pilot for this flight is Captain Jack McLean. Our position at the moment is approximately 550 miles above Earth, and in less than 1/2 hour, we'll be in free fall, completely without gravity. Our speed is currently 29,000 miles per hour. We should arrive at Moonport at exactly 6 p.m. tomorrow, Earth time. I wish you a pleasant voyage. If there's anything you need, Intergalactic is at your service.
You think to yourself, everybody's here. Your husband, his loved one, and his wife. You watch her as she walks back along the rows of seats with an armful of the latest magazine recordings. A tall girl, about 29 or 30, dark brown hair, dark eyes. Not very pretty. The sort who would be able to talk to him about steam tubes and beautiful landings and solar storms.
Mrs. Foster, would you like something to read?
Thank you, no.
First time no rocket ship?
Yes, could you tell?
You look a little green. You feeling well?
Yes, I'm quite all right.
There's just a touch of space sickness. Come along to the ship's hospital and we'll fix you up in the jiffy.
No, I'd rather just sit here a minute.
Of course.
Come on.
Let me help you into the ship's hospital. That's... Come on, take it easy. Now, come on. Now, you just lie down there. How are you feeling?
I'm scared.
There's nothing to be afraid of.
I think there is.
What is it?
I'm pregnant.
What?
I faked my validation papers.
Do you know what you've done to yourself?
I hoped it wouldn't affect me.
There isn't much I can say, Mrs. Foster. I'll have to tell the captain naturally.
But would it be... I mean, Could I tell him myself?
If you'd rather, I'll call him. Stewardess to captain.
McLean, what is it, Dal?
Jack, there's a passenger in the ship's hospital.
What's up?
You'd better come down here.
Well, look, Susie, I've got my course correction.
I think you'd better come right down.
Okay. Charlie, take it, will you? I'll be right back.
He'll be here in a minute or two.
Here, let me put this pillow under your head. Thank you.
Now, what made you do it?
You wouldn't understand.
You loved him, and he's stationed on the moon, and you wanted to be near him. Is that it?
Could you understand that?
You mean not being able to have the man you love? Yes. I think I could understand.
You wanted to scream at her, to claw at her face. She was going to live, and you were going to die. She was going to share a life with Jack when you were only a dim sort of memory in his mind. He came in, moving fast with that kind of schoolboy gait of his. His dark face was frowning, but handsome as ever.
Now, just why did you...
Marcia.
Marcia, honey.
Hello, Jack.
What are you doing aboard?
Sue, this is my wife. Marcia, this is Sue Egan.
Oh, hello. I'll be getting out. Excuse me.
What's going on?
Jack, sit down. I want to tell you something.
I'd like to say something first, Marsh. I've had a chance to do a lot of thinking lately. And if you think we could work it out, I'd like to try again.
You mean that?
Yes, I do.
What about Miss Egan? Sue?
What about her?
Well, I heard...
I'm very fond of Sue.
Yes, I thought you were.
But she isn't my wife. You are.
Was.
What do you mean?
I'm going to die, Jack.
Marcia, what are you talking about?
Jack, I'm pregnant. You see, we're a little too late.
Did you know this when you came aboard?
Yes.
But weren't you aware that... What about the physical?
I used another woman's validation papers. I paid her for them.
Why, Marcia? How could you do a thing like that?
I don't know. I don't know. All I knew was that I had to see you. I had to be with you.
If you'd only told me.
I couldn't reach you.
Didn't you know what would happen if you took a rocket flight?
I know. I thought somehow it wouldn't happen to me. I didn't know that pregnancy was affected.
And if you had?
I would have come along anyway.
I suppose in a way I'm to blame. I'm the one who walked out.
Don't take the blame on yourself. I'm over 21.
Marcia, what did you hope to accomplish by this?
I'm not sure.
There's only one possibility.
Possibility?
Yes, excuse me. Miss Egan.
Yes?
Come into the ship's hospital, please. Bring Petrocelli from maintenance. Tell him to come up here with a crescent wrench.
Yes, Captain.
What are you going to do?
Do? Nothing much. I'm going to warp the ship around, that's all.
Petrocelli was a big, easygoing man. Jack left me alone with him and Miss Egan while he went back to the control room. Petrocelli started to bolt a metal bed to the side wall of the cabin. Why are you putting the bed on the wall?
Because, lady, when he starts to spin the ship, that outside bulk is going to be down, not sideways. Centrifugal force, eh?
I'm afraid I don't.
Well, that's too bad, because I got other things to do besides explain. Okay, Susie, it's all yours.
Is he always that rude?
Doesn't it occur to you that maybe he's under a slight strain?
Strain?
Look, Mrs. McLean, your husband's going to warp the ship around. The chances of his pulling off a maneuver like that without piling us up in the sun or in deep space are about 1,000 to 1. I appreciate that you wanted to see him and show him that he ought to be ashamed of himself for leaving you, but does it occur to you that all of us may lose our lives because of it? Including Petrocelli?
No, I hadn't thought about it.
Let's go. I've got to strap you into that bed.
No, wait. What will happen to me if the ship isn't warped?
Sudden floods of the adrenal glands, convulsions, panic, spastic secretions, and eventually, death.
What causes it?
Lack of gravity. We aren't sure just how. The purpose of spinning the ship is to press you up against the outer wall and create the effect of gravity through centrifugal force.
Do you think he can do it?
I think he's the best skipper in the intergalactic fleet.
That isn't the answer to my question. Can he spin the ship without killing everyone?
I have faith in him.
She loved him. She had faith in him. And you? You to whom he was married? You who carried his child inside you? Did you have faith in him?
Everything set in here?
Yes.
Good.
Jack, could we talk alone for a minute?
Only a minute. We have to get the new data into the computers. Susie, will you excuse us, please?
Yes.
Well?
Jack, don't do it.
Marsh.
I mean it. You've no right to risk all those lives just for me.
Marsh, I'm captain of this ship. I do as I see fit, and I can't do otherwise.
But it isn't fair to them. It isn't fair to you.
When we're born into this life, we don't make any agreement that says everything is going to be fair and equitable.
I refuse to let you do it.
You can't stop me.
I'll take my life.
I'm going to ask Sue to stay with you.
What about her? Don't you love her? Well?
Marsha, whether I love Sue Egan is not the point just now. I've decided to spin ship to save you and my son. Or daughter. If it means risking the lives of others, I have to take that risk.
Jack.
Yes?
Why are you doing it?
Because I love you.
It seemed to me during the next hour, through the haze of the drug they gave me, that I could see him. There was the curved silver board. Before it sat Jack, hunched like a harried bookkeeper on the last day of the month.
Okay, Charlie. We'll come to the moon obliquely at 0.307. We pass it, stop, spin the ship over once to check speed. Then put the tail down when we feel gravity at 7.035. And if we can do it with the fuel we've got, it'll be a miracle. All right. Start the calculators. Engine room. Reverse tubes.
Reverse tubes.
Wait for new course vector 7073.
Ready for new course vector.
Set firing formula 2635726.
Firing formula ready.
Coming into course vector. Counting down. 7077. 76.
76.
75.
75.
7-4.
7-4.
7-3. Fire.
You don't recall much after that. There's the bulkhead pressing against you like a magnet pressing harder and harder. Then there's the needle, and then sudden relaxation. Through it all, the stars and the moon and Jack and Sue Egan dance in a pattern of mist, and the words come back to you from long ago. The things he said to you when you were both in love many years ago.
When I fly the ship, it seems that all Earth watches me through your eyes.
A man comes to love the things he has to fight for, I guess.
How is she?
Hold tight, Marsha. Hold tight to me.
She calls you Marsha. This woman who hates you, who loves your husband, she calls you Marsha.
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 Marsha. Marsha.
The curved ceiling, but a new curve, and soft rose instead of chrome metal. A new feeling, unlike Earth or the ship.
Honey, wake up.
Oh, Jack?
It's all right, honey. We made it. We're on the moon.
Moon?
Yes. You're in the new Lunar City Hospital.
You did it. You really did it.
Well, I've been telling you for years that I was the best pilot in the fleet.
Oh, you don't have to pretend. I know how you must feel about what I did.
I'm not pretending.
I was a selfish coward. I wasn't concerned about anything but my own happiness.
Marsha, there isn't any absolute scale for courage or kindness or goodness. I couldn't pretend to judge you or anybody else. I only know that I believe you're a good person. And I love you. With your faults and your good points.
I just wanted to be with you, Jack. That's all I ever wanted. I'm sorry I'm not brave and strong like Susan or you Where are the others?
Oh, honey, nobody expects you to be. Come on. You've got to save your strength. We've got to take good care of you.
He reaches down and touches your lips with his fingers. It's like a benediction. You know that you'll never again question his right to do the things that fulfill him. To take a silver ship above the earth and guide it to new planets. Our child will be born on the moon, you whisper to him. And our grandchildren in the stars.
You have just heard X-1, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, which this month features the Arthur Sellings tale entitled One Across, the story of a man who thought that doing puzzles was an escape until he suddenly found himself completely boxed in. Galaxy Magazine, on your newsstand today. Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you Jaywalker, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Ross Rocklin and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were Bob Hastings, Terry Keane, Raymond Edward Johnson, Connie Lemke, and Eugene Francis. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
Strange Adventure. The two men halted their horses at the top of a giant sand dune and gazed with tortured eyes across the burning Sahara Desert. The tall bronze Frenchman pointed to a ruined fort shimmering in the heat haze.
There is El Mogreb, the place the Arabs fear so much. They call it the Oasis of Death.
The young American wiped the dust and perspiration from his face.
Yes, Captain. And somewhere within those ruined walls may be the man we're looking for, if the information you have is correct.
Jason Grimm recalled his meeting in Algiers with Captain Ladiz, the former officer of the Foreign Legion. Both men worked for that unique enterprise called Adventure Incorporated, and both had received letters telling of the disappearance of an American news correspondent. The letters had ended with the terse words, "Find George Carew." Jason and Captain Ladiz reached the outskirts of the abandoned village and dismounted behind a huge boulder. There ahead was the Oasis of Death. Captain Ladiz drew his long native robe about him.
You wait with the horses. I'll go in first and look around. If something happens, come in after me.
All afternoon, Jason waited in the sweltering shade of the boulder, then mounted and rode toward the ruined fort. The guard standing at the entrance stared at the stranger in amazement.
I have a pass to see your commander.
The guard stepped back smartly into this place of fear and mystery. A few minutes later, Jason sat in a tiny office conversing with one of the officers of the fort. The officer glowered at his visitor.
Colonel Levesque is in Algiers. I'm in command until he gets back. Hey, wait a minute. You an American? Let's say I was an American. Here, men are without nationalities and without identities.
A shot rang out not far away, followed by others. Several guards were running down the road toward the fort, firing madly as they went. Behind them was an angry, shouting mass of prisoners. Jason and the officer dashed outside and rushed toward the battle. The prisoners shouted angrily and clutched at the horses of Jason and the officer. Jason kicked out and sent men sprawling into the dust. The officer of the fort rode up beside him.
Wait, head for the gate. Your friend's waiting there.
Jason had almost reached the gate when a heavy stone struck him, and he clutched at his saddle as darkness swam into his brain. Jason awoke in a small native hut and stared about him. Captain Ladiz and the officer lounged in chairs across the room. The American smiled at him as he tried to sit up.
Well, glad to see you pulling out of it, son. You got a nasty blow back there. But you're the commander of the slave camp. Oh, no, no. The man whose identity I stole was killed some time ago in Iran. I took his name and won the confidence of Colonel Levesque. I planned the riot that afforded our escape.
Captain Ladiz lighted a cigarette and passed it to Jason.
We, my friend, here is the man we came to find. Permit me to introduce George Carew of the International News Agency.
This is Pat McGeehan in Hollywood, California, saying goodbye from my writer, Charles Crowder, and inviting you to listen again to another tale of... Strange Adventure.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
Now starring Paul Frees as your teller of tales. Another story from The Black Book.
Yes. From the world's most fabulous collection of strange and unusual stories, The Black Book, I've selected a story by Dorothy Horton. She calls it My Favorite Corpse. Artie Paul said goodnight to Lil. Then he walked across town to his hotel. Lil's kiss was still heavy against his lips. Artie smiled as he remembered the pleasures of the evening. Now for tonight, it was ended. But there'd be more evenings like this, many more. At the hotel, he bought a pack of cigarettes, said goodnight to the desk clerk, and went up to his room. He let himself in, flicked on the lights, then placed a telephone call to Long Island. While he waited, he whistled softly through his teeth. There was just one obstacle in the way of complete happiness for Artie. Just one. A voice answered on the other end of the line.
Hello?
Jenny, this is Artie. I just finished that work for the office.
Oh, that's nice, dear.
I didn't realize how late it was until just now. I've decided not to drive home so late at night. I'll stay at the Tarleton.
Well, whatever you think, dear. If it doesn't seem wise to come home, then you'd better stay in town.
I think it's best, Jenny. I'm pretty tired. Call you in the morning from the office, okay?
All right, dear. Good night. And Arthur?
Yes?
Pleasant dreams, darling.
Good night, Jenny.
Arthur put up the receiver on the hook and sat staring out of the hotel window. Somewhere out there beyond the lighted city was his wife, Jenny. His devoted, faithful, understanding wife, whom he was going to kill. Artie wasn't sure just when he first planned to kill his wife, but it was shortly after he met Lil Nelson. It had been one of those electric things. Artie and Lil had met a few times for cocktails after he left the office in the evening before going home. At first, it had been merely an exciting flirtation, but quickly, frighteningly, it had grown to be much more. Now he saw Lil every day. He knew he was in love with her. Then finally, one evening, he told Jenny about it.
But Arthur, you're 15 years older than this girl.
Jenny, look, we've been all over this.
Arthur, it simply wouldn't work. Right now, she seems to mean a great deal to you. But it's just a crush. A passing fascination.
Jenny, I'm sorry. I love Lil. I want a divorce.
You're acting like a schoolboy, Arthur. I don't think we should talk about it anymore.
Jenny, can't you understand what I'm saying? I'm going to leave you.
Now, Arthur, we've been through this before. I won't let you make a fool of yourself over that blonde.
Jenny, you're making a mistake.
Arthur, you need me. This girl wouldn't be good for you. You don't really love her. It's just animal attraction. It'll pass. In a little while, we can look back on this and laugh. I'm right. You wait and see. Arthur, are you listening? I won't let you have a divorce, Arthur. That's final. I know what's best for both of us. Arthur, are you listening to me?
Artie was listening. Listening to all the things he knew Jenny would say. All the platitudes, the truisms, the trite sayings that Jenny understood so well. Oh, Jenny loved him, all right. But with a cloying, maternal love. Nothing like the consuming, flaming desire that was Lil's. If there was any particular moment that Jenny sealed her fate, it was then. Half an hour after she went to bed, Artie left his house
and drove back toward the city. And Lil.
You're really going to do it, Artie?
Yes, I've got it all planned. There won't be any mistakes.
Pour me another drink, baby.
Sure. Funny, she never calls me baby. Always Arthur, like I was a little boy.
You're not a little boy to me. Not at all. Will it be dangerous?
No.
When, baby?
It'll take time. 2, maybe 3 months. But I've got it planned. Then you won't be stuck in this second floor walk-up. You'll live where you want.
You's good enough for me.
We'll travel, have fun.
Florida, Bermuda.
You and me, Lil.
Soon?
Soon.
Three days after he made his decision, Artie bought a small .32 caliber gun. Then he began his period of stage setting. Lil was never mentioned in his home again. She stopped coming by the office to see him. There were no more cocktail rendezvous in the dark bar. And as time passed, people at the office forgot about her. The kidding died away. At bridge parties, his friends remarked on how nice it was to see a couple so much in love as Jenny and Arthur. They were getting along wonderfully. In the months that followed, Artie sat through countless dull plays and movies holding Jenny's hand. All the while, he ached to be with Lil. Artie wasn't certain that Jenny was fooled by all this sudden affection, but he knew their friends were. And then, after what seemed eternity, the night came. And Artie was glad. It was to be a Wednesday night, the night that Jenny went to her reading club. She'd be home around 10 o'clock. Artie went to work setting up his alibi. He phoned Jenny, then let it be known around the office he'd have to work late, might even stay in town. He ate dinner, then with his briefcase under his arm, sat down in the lobby of the Tarleton, in full sight of the night clerk. It was 8:15. Artie acted his part to perfection. By 8:30, he was nodding. At 9:05, he raised his head, blinked and looked around. Getting up, he walked to the night clerk.
Well, that's one for the books. Fell asleep right there in the lobby. Look, I'm going up to my room. Nothing short of an atom bomb could get me out of bed tonight.
And the night clerk laughed with him. Artie went up to his room, waited 15 minutes, turned out the lights, and quietly, carefully climbed out the window onto the fire escape. 3 minutes later, he was in his car. 40 minutes later, he was climbing in the library window of his own home. He looked at his watch. 10 o'clock. That was good. Jenny'd be home any minute. He moved quickly to the hallway by the front door and slid into the hall closet, pressing himself back into the darkness. Jenny was such a creature of habit, he knew exactly what she'd do. After she came in, she'd lock the front door, put the key on the hall table, take off her coat, and hang it in the closet. Artie stood in the darkness, his hand wet around the butt of the gun he held. The complete lack of any sound was terrifying. But any minute now, it was the door. She was home. His ears strained, listening. Stale air of the closet made him dizzy. Then a sound he hadn't expected. What was the fool crying about? Now she was walking, just walking back and forth, and crying, crying softly to herself. Then the crying stopped. She was right outside the closet now. He pressed farther back. Now the door was opening and a knife blade of light sliced into the closet. The coat slithered off a hanger onto the floor. Jenny bent down to pick it up. And her eyes found his shoes, his legs. He traveled up to his face. And a rasping cry. Her eyes wide. Artie lunged.
I tell you something.
Artie dragged her into the smothering closeness of the hanging coats and pulled the trigger. As he drove back into the city, Artie knew he'd been very clever. It would look like suicide. He'd pressed Jenny's lifeless fingers around the butt of the gun. It was lying on the floor now, close to her body. It was all so simple. After he parked the car, Artie started for the hotel. But as he walked, a sudden desire made him hesitate. If only he could see Lil for a second, she'd want to know. A few minutes later, he was climbing the back stairs to Lil's apartment. He found the door unlocked and opened it.
Lil? Lil, it's Artie. Where are you, honey?
There was no answer. He stepped into the living room and suddenly something burst inside his head. Lil. Lil was lying on the floor, doll-like, grotesque. The blue robe he'd given her was stained with blood. A gun lay beside her.
Artie, help me.
Lil. Lil, baby.
Oh, it hurts, Artie. Make it stop hurting.
Lil. Lil, what happened?
She shot me.
She? Who?
She came in, said she wanted talk, but shot me.
Lil.
She's...
Lil, I'll call a doctor.
Said she knew. For months she knew about me.
Baby, when please don't try to talk.
When she shot me, your wife laughed. Artie. Oh, Artie.
Lil.
Artie got to his feet. Lil was dead. He picked up the gun. It was his gun. His gun. The one he'd always had around the house. The one he had registered in his name. Now, too late, he remembered he hadn't seen it for several days. Of course, Jenny had taken it when she planned a murder of her own. Jenny had fooled both of them. And Artie stood there for a moment, looking down at Lil. Tears filled his eyes and spilled over. After a moment, he walked to the phone and slowly picked up the receiver. I want the police. Please, this is Arthur Powell. I want to report two murders. One at my home on Long Island, and the other here at the River Crest.
The Black Book stars Paul Frees as your teller of tales, assisted today by the noted Hollywood actress Virginia Gregg. Dorothy Horton's suspense magazine story, My Favorite Corpse, was adapted and directed by Norman MacDonald. The special music is composed and conducted by Leith Stevens. Remember, the comedy treat that can't be beat is Jack Benny Time, Sunday nights on the CBS Radio Network.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Today's reading by Tom Hackett, djhackett.newgrounds.com. Beyond Lies the Wub by Philip K. Dick. They had almost finished with the loading. Outside stood the Optus, his arms folded, his face sunk in gloom. Captain Franco walked leisurely down the gangplank, grinning. "What's the matter?" he said. "You're getting paid for all this." The Optus said nothing. He turned away, collecting his robes. The captain put his boot on the hem of the robe. "Just a minute. Don't go off. I'm not finished." "Oh?" The Optus turned with dignity. "I am going back to the village." He looked toward the animals and birds being driven up the gangplank into the spaceship. "I must organize new hunts." Franco lit a cigarette. "Why not? You people can go out into the veldt and track it all down again. But when we run out halfway between Mars and Earth, the Optus went off, wordless. Franco joined the first mate at the bottom of the gangplank. How's it coming? He said. He looked at his watch. We got a good bargain here. The mate glanced at him sourly. How do you explain that? What's the matter with you? We need it more than they do. I'll see you later, Captain. The mate threaded his way up the plank, between the long-legged Martian go-birds, into the ship. Franco watched him disappear. He was just starting up after him, up the plank toward the port, when he saw it. My God! He stood staring, his hands on his hips. Peterson was walking along the path, his face red, leading it by a string. I'm sorry, Captain, he said, tugging at the string. Franco walked toward him. What is it? The wub stood sagging, its great body settling slowly. It was sitting down, its eyes half shut. A few flies buzzed about its flank, and it switched its tail. It sat. There was silence. It's a wub, Peterson said. I got it from a native for 50 cents. He said it was a very unusual animal, very respected. This? Franco poked the great sloping side of the wub. It's a pig! A huge, dirty pig! Yes, sir, it's a pig. The natives call it a wub. A huge pig. Must weigh 400 pounds. Franco grabbed a tuft of the rough hair. The wub gasped, its eyes open, small and moist. Then its great mouth twitched. A tear rolled down the wub's cheek and splashed on the floor. Maybe it's good to eat, Peterson said nervously. We'll soon find out, Franco said. The wub survived the takeoff, sound asleep in the hold of the ship. When they were out in space and everything was running smoothly, Captain Franco bade his men fetch the wub upstairs so that he might perceive what manner of beast it was. The wub grunted and wheezed, squeezing up the passageway. Come on, Jones grated, pulling at the rope. The wub twisted, rubbing its skin off on the smooth chrome walls. It burst into the anteroom, tumbling down in a heap. The men leaped up. Lord, Frank said. What is it? Peterson says it's a wub, Jones said. It belongs to him. He kicked at the wub. The wub stood up unsteadily, panting. What's the matter with it? French came over. Is it going to be sick? They watched. The wub rolled its eyes mournfully. It glanced around at the men. I think it's thirsty, Peterson said. He went to get some water. French shook his head. No wonder we had so much trouble taking off. I had to reset all my ballast calculations. Peterson came back with the water. The wub began to lap gratefully, splashing the men. Captain Franco appeared at the door. Let's have a look at it, he advanced, squinting critically. You got this for 50 cents? Yes, sir, Peterson said. It eats almost anything. I fed it on grain, and it liked that. Then potatoes, and mash, and scraps from the table, and milk. It seems to enjoy eating. After it eats, it lies down and goes to sleep. I see, Captain Franco said. Now, as to its taste, that's the real question. I doubt if there's much point in fattening it up anymore. It seems fat enough to me already. Where's the cook? I want him here. I want to find out. The wub stopped lapping and looked up at the captain.
Really, Captain, the wub said. I suggest we talk of other matters.
The room was silent.
What was that? Franco said. Just now. The wub, sir, Peterson said. It spoke.
They all looked at the wub.
What did it say? What did it say? It suggested we talk about other things.
Franco walked toward the wub. He went all around it, examining it from every side. Then he came back over and stood with the men. I wonder if there's a native inside it, he said thoughtfully. Maybe we should open it up and have a look.
Oh, goodness, the wub cried. Is that all you people can think of? Killing and cutting?
Franco clenched his fist.
Come out of there! Whoever you are, come out!
Nothing stirred. The men stood together, their faces blank, staring at the wub. The wub swished its tail. It belched suddenly.
I beg your pardon, the wub said.
I don't think there's anyone in there, Jones said in a low voice. They all looked at each other. The cook came in.
You wanted me, Captain? He said. What's this thing?
This is a wub, Franco said. It's to be eaten. Will you measure it and figure out?
I think we should have a talk, the wub said. I'd like to discuss this with you, Captain, if I might. I can see that you and I do not agree on some basic issues.
The captain took a long time to answer. The wub waited good-naturedly, licking the water from its jowls.
Come into my office, the captain said at last.
He turned and walked out of the room. The wub rose and padded after him. The men watched it go out. They heard it climbing the stairs.
I wonder what the outcome will be,
the cook said.
Well, I'll be in the kitchen. Let me know as soon as you're here.
Sure, Jones said. Sure. The wub eased itself down in the corner with a sigh.
You must forgive me, it said. I'm afraid I'm addicted to various forms of relaxation. When one is as large as I... The captain nodded impatiently.
He sat down at his desk and folded his hands.
All right, he said. Let's get started. You're a wub, is that correct?
The wub shrugged.
I suppose so. That's what they call us, the natives, I mean. We have our own term.
And you speak English? You've been in contact with Earthmen before?
No.
Then how do you do it?
Speak English? Am I speaking English? I'm not conscious of speaking anything in particular. I examined your mind.
My mind?
I studied the contents, especially the semantic warehouse, as I refer to it.
I see, Captain said. Telepathy, of course.
We are a very old race, the wub said. Very old and very ponderous. It is difficult for us to move around. You can appreciate that anything so slow and heavy would be at the mercy of more agile forms of life. There was no use in our relying on physical defenses. How could we win? Too heavy to run, too soft to fight, too good-natured to hunt for game.
How do you live?
Plants, vegetables. We can eat almost anything. We're very Catholic. Tolerant, eclectic, Catholic. We live and let live. That's how we've gotten along.
The wub eyed the captain.
And that's why I so violently objected to this business about having me boiled. Could see the image in your mind. Most of me in the frozen food locker, some of me in a kettle, a bit of your pet cat.
So you read minds, the captain said. How interesting. Anything else? I mean, what else can you do along those lines?
A few odds and ends, the wub said absently, staring around the room. A nice apartment you have here, Captain. You keep it quite neat. I respect life forms that are tidy. Some Martian birds are quite tidy. They throw things out of their nest and sweep them.
Indeed, the captain nodded. But to get back to the problem...
Quite so. You spoke of dining on me. The taste, I am told, is good. A little fatty, but tender. But how can any lasting contact be established between your people and mine if you resort to such barbaric attitudes? Eat me. Rather, you should discuss questions with me. Philosophy, the arts...
The captain stood up.
Philosophy. It might interest you to know that we will be hard put to find something to eat for the next month.
An unfortunate spoilage, I know, the wub nodded. But wouldn't it be more in accord with your principles of democracy if we all drew straws or something along that line? After all, democracy is to protect the minority from just such infringements. Now, if each of us cast one vote...
The captain walked to the door.
Nuts to you, he said.
He opened the door. He opened his mouth. He stood frozen, his mouth wide, his eyes staring, his fingers still on the knob. The wub watched him. Presently it padded out of the room, edging past the captain. It went down the hall, deep in meditation. The room was quiet.
So you see, the wub said, we have a common myth. Your mind contains many familiar myth symbols. Ishtar, Odysseus.
Peterson sat silently, staring at the floor. He shifted in his chair.
Go on, he said. Please, go on.
I find in your Odysseus a figure common to the mythology of most self-conscious races. As I interpret it, Odysseus wanders as an individual, aware of himself as such. This is the idea of separation from family and country, a process of individuation.
But Odysseus returns to his home.
Peterson looked out the port window, at the stars, endless stars, burning intently in the empty universe.
Finally, he goes home.
As must all creatures. The moment of separation is a temporary period, a brief journey of the soul. Begins, it ends. The wanderer returns to land and race.
The door opened. The wub stopped, turning its great head. Captain Franco came into the room, the men behind him.
They hesitated at the door. Are you all right? Frank said.
Do you mean me?
Peterson said, surprised.
Why me?
Franco lowered his gun.
Come over here, he said to Peterson. Get up and come here.
There was silence.
Go ahead, the wub said. It doesn't matter.
Peterson stood up.
What for?
It's an order.
Peterson walked to the door. French caught his arm.
What's going on?
Peterson wrenched loose.
What's the matter with you?
Captain Franco moved toward the wub. The wub looked up from where it lay in the corner, pressed against the wall.
It is interesting, the wub said, that you are obsessed with the idea of eating me. I wonder why.
Get up,
Franco said.
If you wish, the wub rose, grunting. Be patient, it is difficult for me.
It stood gasping, its tongue lolling foolishly.
Shoot it now, French said. For God's sake!
Peterson exclaimed. Jones turned to him quickly, his eyes gray with fear.
You didn't see him, like a statue standing there, his mouth open. If we hadn't come down, he'd still be there.
Who, the captain? Peterson stared around.
But he's all right now.
They looked at the wub standing in the middle of the room, its great chest rising and falling.
Come on, Franco said. Out of the way.
The men pulled aside toward the door.
You are quite afraid, aren't you?
The wub said.
Have I done anything to you? I am against the idea of hurting. All I have done is try to protect myself. Can you expect me to rush eagerly to my death? I am a sensible being like yourselves. I was curious to see your ship, learn about you. I suggested to the native. The gun jerked.
See? Franco said. I thought so.
The wub settled down, panting. It put its paw out, pulling its tail around it.
It is very warm, the wub said. I understand that we are close to the jets. Atomic power. You have done many wonderful things with it, technically. Apparently your scientific hierarchy is not equipped to solve moral, ethical... Franco turned to the men, crowding behind him, wide-eyed, silent.
I'll do it. You can watch.
French nodded.
Try to hit the brain. It's no good for eating. Don't hit the chest.
If the ribcage shatters, we'll have to pick bones out.
Listen,
Peterson said, licking his lips.
Has it done anything? What harm has it done? I'm asking you. And anyhow, it's still mine. You have no right to shoot it. It doesn't belong to you.
Franco raised his gun.
I'm going out, Jones said, his face white and sick. I don't want to see it.
Me too,
French said, and then straggled out, murmuring. Peterson lingered at the door.
He was talking to me about Miss, he said. It wouldn't hurt anyone.
He went outside. Franco walked toward the wub. The wub looked up slowly and swallowed.
A very foolish thing, said. I'm sorry that you want to do it. There was a parable that your savior related.
It stopped, staring at the gun.
Can you look me in the eye and do it?
The wub said.
Can you do that?
The captain gazed down.
I can look you in the eye, he said. Back on the farm we had hogs. Dirty, razorback hogs. I can do it.
Staring down at the wub, into the gleaming, moist eyes, he pressed the trigger. The taste was excellent. They sat glumly around the table, some of them hardly eating at all. The only one who seemed to be enjoying himself was Captain Franco.
More? He said, looking around. More? And some wine, perhaps.
Not me, Friend said. I think I'll go back to the chart room.
Me too.
Jones stood up, pushing his chart back. I'll see you later. The captain watched them go. Some of the others excused themselves.
What do you suppose the matter is? The
captain said. He turned to Peterson. Peterson sat, staring down at its plate, at the potatoes, the green peas, and at the thick slab of tender, warm meat. He opened his mouth. No sound came. The captain put his hand on Peterson's shoulder.
It is only organic matter now, he said. The life essence is gone.
He ate, spooning up the gravy with some bread.
I, myself, love to eat. It is one of the great things that a living creature can enjoy. Eating, resting, meditation, discussing things.
Peterson nodded. Two more men got up and went out. The captain drank some water and sighed.
Well, he said, I must say that this was a very enjoyable meal. All the reports I had heard were quite true. The taste of wub, very fine. But I was prevented from enjoying this pleasure in times past.
He dabbed at his lips with his napkin and leaned back in his chair. Peterson stared dejectedly at the table. The captain watched him intently. He leaned over.
Come, come, he said. Cheer up. Let's discuss things.
He smiled.
As I was saying before I was interrupted, the role of Odysseus in the mess...
Peterson jerked up, staring.
To go on, the captain said. Odysseus, as I understand him.
End of Beyond Lies the Wub by Philip K. Dick. Recorded by Tom Hackett.
djhackett.newgrounds.com.